Welcome to another talk on this amazing Easter 2010 retreat on Friday morning, if I got it right. And yesterday's talk was talking about insight, and I wanted to continue on that subject, especially understanding how do we know it's insight and how do we know we're being deluded? How can we tell that what we think is right is actually right? Because one of the key teachings of the Buddha is the power of delusion. That it's because we're deluded, we don't see things as they truly are. That's why we crave, that's why we attach, that's why we keep getting reborn, and that's why we keep making a lot of suffering in our lives. So the enemy number one, as far as Buddhism is concerned, is delusion. Sometimes they call it ignorance, but ignorance is far too academic for me. I know people who are professors of Buddhism, who know more Buddhist teachings than I do, who know Pali much better and Sanskrit, who know much more, but they're certainly very deluded. So it's not just knowledge, it's something much deeper than that. That's why I like to call the avijja the core problem of human existence. It's not as ignorance, not as if you don't know, but you just don't understand. That's why I call it delusion. And one of the other reasons I want to give this talk, I want to confess that the best question we got last night about the feminist lesbian who had many erotic partners and whose husband just paid for her, that was from a guy. It was a joke question. It deluded me. So when you get curly questions like that, I have to be very careful I don't offend anybody. So, you know, you thought it may be a joke question, but you found out it actually was. But nevertheless, why is it that sometimes we get deluded? Why is it sometimes we misunderstand and don't get it quite right? And it's the whole purpose of, not the whole purpose, one of the great purposes of this stilling the mind is so that you can overcome that delusion, so you can see things as they truly are. Because when you start developing that stillness of mind, you're overcoming these five hindrances, which I talked about earlier. And they're not just things which block your peace of mind. They're also things which bend the truth to fit yourself. I've often so said in public, just, you know, there's two types of religion in this world. Which bends the truth to fit your beliefs, and that which bends your beliefs to fit the truth. And you might say, yeah, Buddhism is of the type which will always bend the beliefs to fit the facts. But sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes even Buddhists believe in some really weird and crazy things. You only have to look to know how many people wear these amulets or these strings to think, gee, I mean, what are you doing that for? And you know, even there's one of the sutras of the Buddha, which you know you mentioned a few times, but you know it's quite challenging. People are asking the Buddha about the efficacy of chanting, especially you know sharing of merits and chanting for deceased. And the Buddha said, suppose someone got a pot of ghee was this oily stuff, and they broke it over a lake. And of course, the clay, the pot, so as you call it, the broken clay would go down to the bottom because it's heavier than the water. The oil would float on the surface. And the Buddha said, suppose a monk would come along and do some chanting. Oh, may the oil sink to the bottom and may the clay rise to the surface. Would that be possible? And the guy said, no. And the Buddha said, exactly. Just the clay goes to the bottom, the oil goes to the top. It's just like the person who chants for somebody who's dead. If they've gone to the bottom, they've gone to the bottom. If they've floated to the top, they've floated to the top. And all the chanting could hardly do any effect at all. But how many people would actually accept that? Because a human being is always so superstitious. There used to be this scam going on in Malaysia and also in Singapore. And I've told you about this before, for those who have been in Malaysia and Singapore. What they used to do, when sort of your mother or father is dead, they bring in the monks or the nuns to do some chanting. And after they did the chanting, the monk would feel the head and the feet. Because if the head was the last to be warm, not the feet. The feet were cold, the head was warm. That meant their soul, they didn't believe in the soul anyway, but they said their soul had left through the head, which means it must go to heaven. But if the feet were warm last and the head was cold, that means the soul would have gone through the feet and gone down to the hell realms. So they chanted and chanted and chanted to make sure the head was the last thing warm and the feet were the last things cold. It was cold first. Otherwise, it went the other way around. It would go to hell. So sometimes they got these real scallywags. You know, Singaporeans, some of the men who had their China wives, their little mistresses in the back, you know, playing around. And so they did lots and lots of chanting. And they did find, yes, the head was warm. Ah, oh, wonderful monks. You made my father go to heaven, even though it's a very difficult thing to chant for him because of what he's done in his life. We all know the scandals. But he managed to do it. Well done. They give extra Ang Pao donations. But anybody who's got even the smallest understanding of biology knows that on the dying process, the last place where the blood goes to keep it warm is your brain, because that's the headquarters. That's why they call it headquarters, because that's where the main sort of stuff is done. That's the most important part of you. So it'll always be the case. Everyone who dies, well, their feet would go cold first and the head would go cold last of all. So it doesn't matter you chant or not, it'll always work the same. But because people convince you, yeah, the head was warm and they feel it, yeah, it's right, so they're going to go to heaven. So they get extra donation. That's a total scam, but still people believe in that stuff. Still people believe that if you burn all this paper, they're going to sort of get all this stuff up in heaven. Just think about it, all the superstitions about heaven. And you go to heaven. I mean, if everybody goes to heaven, what's going to happen? So how many wives? What happens to your wife is in heaven, your mistress is in heaven? You're going to have the same problems you had back here on earth. It's not going to help you at all. So the whole stuff is totally superstitious. But why do people believe in that stuff? This was something, you know, it's like someone trained as a scientist. It was really an interesting, not that people believe these things, but why they believe all this sort of stuff which people do believe. Why is it they get these cults? You know, like I always remember the classic case was Heaven's Gate, where these very highly educated people in the United States believed there was a meteor coming, and behind the meteor there was a spaceship, and it was going to take everyone of their cult sort of off up to heaven, and everyone else would get destroyed. And the only way to get on that spacecraft was to commit suicide, first of all. So they all killed themselves. Absolutely crazy stuff. Even now. So how many questions I get about a movie which is supposed to be about the end of the world in 2012. And some people actually believe that. It's crazy just the amount of delusion which people have. So what really fascinated me is, why do people think that way? Why are they deluded? And so the investigation came is, how can anyone believe such stuff? And it was great to come across the teachings of the Buddha. He didn't just say that people were deluded, but he actually explained how it happens. And how just like it's a cognitive disorder as a human being. And you can, once he explained it, it became quite clear how it happens. But it also came very scary. Because once you find out how delusion happens, you really start to question yourself. Am I deluded? Have I got it right? Because what happens, once you sort of get a certain idea, a certain view, for example, that sort of God created this earth 5,000 or 6,000 years ago, once you have that view, then that actually affects the way you perceive the world. In fact, your perceptions get filtered through the power of your views. So any evidence which challenges your views, you literally don't see it. Now you can't process it. I know that no one knows if this was true or not, but they have the old saying that when Columbus and his fleet of ships first landed in those islands in the Caribbean, that the Indians, they were looking out into the ocean, they couldn't see the ships, even though they were there. And the reason is because their perceptual framework couldn't accept that such things existed. So their eyes saw it, but their minds couldn't. There was I'm not quite sure if that's true, but to me that's understandable. Because anything which is so against our views, just our mind will not be able to process it. It just won't understand it. We just won't know it. It's filtered out. But anything else, any clue which supports sort of what we want to believe, that is accepted in to our mind. So even what we call bare perception is untrustworthy. Simply because it's not bare perception. By the time these things have arrived in our mind, all the things we don't want to see have been filtered out. And the things we do want to see, they've been amplified and exaggerated. And there's so many psychology examples of this. One of the fascinating ones was done at Harvard, where the professors were showing their students in a movie theater just a short flash. It was a picture somewhere, you know, something they should recognize, you know, in Boston. And the flash was far too short for them to actually to understand what it was. The exposure was just too quick. And then they increased the exposure. And then they increased the exposure. And then they increased the exposure until they could get some idea what it was. And they would actually write it down what they thought it was. And they keep increasing the exposure, so they can be certain what they saw was actually, or what they thought it was actually true. Now, one key example was they had an exposure of the steps, I think, of the biology buildings. You know, a part of campus which every student would know. But because it was so quick, one or two of the students said it was a ship, you know, a ship on the river in the city. And the amazing thing was that once they thought it was a ship, they kept on seeing it as a ship, and seeing it as a ship, and seeing it as a ship. Even though the exposures were so long that any normal person seeing that exposure for the first time would notice it. It's not a ship, it's steps. But because they had the view, the understanding that was a ship, their mind actually contradicted what they saw to confirm their earlier view. Never underestimate the power of those views. Once you have the view there, ordinary evidence which should sort of overturn that view is not strong enough. Which is why you can see the views which you have, they bend your perception to fit your views. And of course, once you perceive in a certain way, you know, the earth was formed 5,000 years ago, or 6,000 years ago, by a creator God. Once you have that view, any perception which counters that view is just blotted out of your mind. Perceptions which confirm that view is kept. And it's on those perceptions, on those ideas, that we think. This is the evidence from which we draw our conclusions. From perceptions, we think. And the thinking just confirms our views. Yeah, we were right. So if you believe that Buddhism is the best religion, any perception which challenges that view, you will not see. Any perceptions which enhance and encourage that view, they will be allowed into your brain. And then you go thinking and thinking, yes, Buddhism is the best religion, it's obvious. And that will just confirm your view. And you go in this cycle of cognitive delusion. Views confirm, views selecting perceptions. Perceptions feeding your thoughts. And thoughts justifying your views. And that's very scary. Because once you start with a view, it's so hard to dislodge it. So the point is, how do we know we started with the right view to begin with? Is Buddhism the correct religion? Because sometimes it happens, you know, if you're really looking for nimittas, and this is a problem with me, because I start to describe too much about these nimittas, and people want to see them so much, but actually, they construct them. They're not real ones. The mind makes them. Even sometimes jhanas. Sometimes people read about them, explain them so much, you actually create them. It's a deluded jhana, it's not the real thing. So this is very dangerous when you start to work with the mind like this. And that whole idea explained by the Buddha of, you know, from views, and they filter out perceptions. Perceptions are what the thinking feeds on, and the thinking justifies and reinforces the views. That explains so much, you know, why some people have, to me, obviously crazy ideas. You know, religions which think if you blow yourself up, you're going to have I don't know how many black-eyed virgins after when you die. Or people who do some crazy, crazy things. You know, thinking just jumping up and down and speaking gobbledygook is sometimes being imbued by some sort of holy mad spirit. And all that sort of stuff people believe in intrinsically, and it really affects their lives. So this is a problem. How do we know that we're not bending our perception? And this is where the Buddhists not only gave the problem about why people can't see the truth, why people believe in all sorts of crazy things, and why the thing which we believe in, we assume, isn't one of those crazy things, but it might be. Not only explained it, but he also saw the antidote, how to get out of that delusion. But how you get out of that delusion, you cannot trust, you know, just thinking out your views and using reason. Which is why what many Buddhists try to do, Christians try to do, they try to reason and philosophize this whole theology departments, you know, which use thinking to try and justify their particular branch of their religion. And these are very intelligent people. So if they were so intelligent, can't they find out which one is right, which one is wrong? That's what I always thought. Now, if you're intelligent enough, you train your mind, you get enough information, and surely, you know, the professors at these universities would be able to agree on what's right, what's wrong, and of course they don't. So just thinking is not good enough. Even just what some people say, just trusting bare perception. That's what I thought in the early days. Just be mindful, trust your bare perception, you know, without thinking, and that will be accurate, that will be reliable. But later on I found you can't even trust bare perception. I've already given you examples of just how perception can play around with you. Some of you already have perceptions which are really interesting when you're meditating. And I mention this because a few people have said this. A common one in meditation, you're sitting here and you think you're moving backwards and forwards, or you're shaking, or you're dancing, or whatever it is you think you're supposed to be doing and deep in your meditation. And you're sitting absolutely still. And for a person who experiences that, it's incredible for them to accept that they were still. Because for them, it's so obvious, yes, they were moving, yes, they were shaking, yes, we're moving all around. To them, that's so obvious, that's true. And it got with one woman some time ago. She was always saying, every time I meditate, I'm rocking backwards and forwards. And I said, well, I've never noticed you. She said, I am. And I said, okay, look, next meditation, I'm going to open my eyes in the middle of the meditation and check you out. It's okay. So I opened my eyes, and she was sitting perfectly still. A really nice posture. And after meditation, she said, did you see me? I was rocking again. I said, no, you weren't. She said, yes, I was. I said, look, I was watching you. You weren't. And I sort of said, I'm going to get a video camera and tape you so you can see for yourself. But to her, it was absolutely clear that she was rocking. Perception. It's not that reliable. Well, you think's happening. Sometimes it's not happening at all. I again mentioned some of my early times when I started questioning perception, when I saw that towel, the black towel incident. And that was just the beginning of many things. Sometimes you're watching a brick wall and it was just like melted like chocolate on a hot day, like ice cream. It just all sort of started drooping. And that was a solid brick wall. Am I going crazy? I wasn't going crazy. I'm a very sort of stable sort of monk, at least I think. Tell crazy, stupid jokes, I know, but I mean, I don't think they've got a word for that. I know they've got schizophrenic and psychotic, but people who tell stupid jokes, have they got a word for that? Should invent a word for that. Sorry?
A joker.
No, some sort of big Latin word, you know, which makes it sound more impressive. But anyway, you weren't a crazy fellow, it's just you realize this was how your perception starts to work. Take another very common case, which many of you have experienced yourself, when you fall in love. And that person you fall in love with, she is the most beautiful, wonderful person in the world. She is so perfect in every way. Yes, I know Ajahn Chah said, ask for a bottle of her shit, but I'm sure even her shit smells like her perfume. She's that perfect. She's special. There's no one else like her in this whole world. Even the way she picks her nose is so charming. whatever it is. And that the boy, you're so strong, you're so nice. And that's, you know that, you've been married, it's delusion, isn't it? But at the time, you tell somebody who's just fallen in love all the mistakes about sort of, you know, their girlfriend, and they just won't hear it. They just don't want to listen to it. And then after 3 or 4 years of marriage, you know, this doesn't happen to everybody, maybe 3, 4, 5 years, it's divorce time. I hate that guy. He's a hopeless guy. No, there's nothing good about him at all. And you go to the other end of delusion, which is total hatred. You can't see anything good about that person. Which one was right? A few years ago, you thought the most wonderful, perfect, amazing being in the whole world. And now you think there's not even one molecule in them which is pure and perfect and nice. You can see just how delusion works. The reason is when you fall in love, you just want to see the beauty in another person. And anything which is going to challenge that view, which you want so much, will be filtered out. And when you're angry and upset and about to get divorced, anything, any redeeming qualities in your ex, you just filter out. You just won't see them at all. The perception will not be able to see anything which is good. And you can see how this happens with your anger and your desire. Why do you get angry at a person? I often tell people, the people you hate, anyone you really hate, your enemy number one, they've got many other people who love them, who think they're wonderful people. And you wonder, how can that happen? How can anyone love that bastard if they only knew what they did to me? But then, people actually love them. So, who's right and who's wrong? If you hate someone, you're just perceiving in a certain way and you're blocking out everything else, any redeeming qualities in that person. When you love them, and I'm not talking about unconditional love, I'm talking about the romantic love, you block out all the negative qualities in them. You're bending your perception again. And how often does that run our world? Well, we don't see the full picture. We just, our perception is just so biased. And because of that, we think. And we think in that particular way, which reinforces our view, which keeps that perception being bent. Now already, I mentioned sort of desire and ill will. Because they're the main two enemies which bend perception. Whenever we want something, we're bending our perception. We're distorting it. Because when we want something, we want to gain something, we want to see something, we want to experience something. And everything which doesn't fulfill our wants, we tend to filter out. The same with ill will. When we're upset, anything which challenges that view of being upset, we filter out. So, are you a good meditator or not? Have you had a good retreat? If you're in a bad mood, you think this retreat sucks. This is the worst retreat and I'm a hopeless meditator. Any beautiful meditations you may have had, any redeeming qualities in yourself, you will not see. And you get upset and depressed. Because you filter out the positive when you're in that negative ill will mode. And you think, I can't do this, I can't succeed. Anyone who thinks, I can't get into jhana, I'm a hopeless case. You know, when the jhana gene was given out, you know, I was last in line and never got one. Just like those people who missed out on the ice cream the other day. Did anyone miss out on the ice cream? No, they didn't. Did anyone have two? But whatever happens, if you really want something, you're distorting perception. If you don't want it, you're distorting perception. This wanting and ill will are the main two enemies which block the truth. So the only way that you can end distortion and see things as they truly are is to somehow suppress wanting and ill will. The first two of these hindrances. Desire and negativity have both to be abandoned. So you don't see what's there. So you don't see what you want to see. You don't reject what you don't want to see. You see whatever's there. on that same experiment done at Harvard, I already mentioned the story of like there's the steps at the biology department and people thinking it was a ship. They said the image which took people the longest time to get right, to actually to see clearly, was one of two dogs copulating. And it was an objectionable image. And because people didn't want to see that, they just couldn't see it. It took them a long time before they actually see what was really there. And of course, there's quite a few psychologists and therapists in this audience. You know that's what happens. People just can't see their faults. Because they just don't want to see their faults. They're in denial of their faults. In the same way, sometimes they're in denial of their good qualities as well, because they don't want to see them. They're negative. So when we abandon the like and the dislike, then we can actually start trusting our perceptions. But it's a hard thing to do, to abandon our likes and dislikes. Our likes and dislikes is what makes you do things, what makes you crave, what makes you move. So this is one of the reasons why that we have to practice this meditation, to get our mind so still that it's beyond like and dislike, beyond all these measurings, beyond all our preferences, where there's no more wanting, there's no more ill will. To counter the ill will, we have this loving kindness, the door of my heart's open to this moment. You know, make peace, be kind, and be gentle. And to stop this sort of the wanting, we just to make peace. So we're with this moment, we let it be. So with letting be and with kindness, these two things going together, letting this thing be, being kind to whatever's happening right now, you're overcoming the major problems which distort your perception and stop you seeing the truth. And when you overcome those two, there's a good chance you may see the truth. You may see the truth about, you know, who you are. That big sort of thing about anatta. Because people just are so afraid of seeing anatta, they just don't want to see they don't exist. It's one of the scariest things to do because it challenges you to the core that most people just can't see it. It's because of their ill will. They don't want to not exist. It's the same way as their desire, you know, to have sex. I mean, many times I've gone on record of saying that this meditation is better than sex, and sometimes people have got upset at me and said, does that mean, you know, if I meditate I have to give up sex? If that's the case, I'm not going to meditate anymore. I said, please, Ajahn Brahm, can you give me permission to be enlightened and to have sex at the same time? And of course it's just that sort of total delusion of trying to bend the truth, because now they think that sex is the best thing, it's their happiness, it's their pleasure, because they don't know anything better. Even once, this is a saying of the Buddha, and he said this to Ananda, and it was one of those great comments about the Buddha, especially in a climate where the Catholic Church is beginning to question once again its commitment to celibacy for its priests. And when the Catholic Church starts to discuss the efficacy and the dangers of celibacy, I'm sure that will come to the Buddhist monks and nuns as well. You know, is celibacy psychologically dangerous? And of course, you know, you quote the Buddha, who said, you know, the lack of celibacy, so that sensuality, that sexuality, he said it's just, you know, thinking that's happiness and fun is a distortion of perception. When I first read that, what do you mean distortion of perception? Sex is fun. I remember having sex, it was good fun. The Buddha said, no, you're just distorting your perception. And then I started to think more deeply about what was going on. I still remember the time when I had my first pint of beer as a 14-year-old, breaking the law like, you know, most young boys tend to want to do, challenging boundaries. I had my first pint of beer. It was very exciting, sneaking into a pub, you know, it was in Richmond, and, you know, pretending to be old and getting your first half a pint of beer and feeling, you know, I'm a man now, I'm drinking beer. Because everyone drinks beer in country like England. And when I started sipping it, I almost was sick. It tasted terrible. And I thought, why is this beer so celibate? Why is everyone drinking this? This is disgusting stuff. You know, it was bitter, it was warm, and didn't taste anything like I expected it to. And I couldn't understand why on earth people like this, you know, this rubbish. You know, even sometimes you have the, slang word for beer being piss. And I thought, now I understand why they call it piss. That's an Australian, they call it having a piss up. And you understand why they call it that, because it tasted like that. And after a while, I thought, gee, this is disgusting. But because it was socially and a social imperative that, you know, to be sort of one of the boys, you had to drink beer. It's just what was done. And if you didn't drink beer, you know, be almost excommunicated from society. You'd be excluded. And so I kept on drinking it. And it only took me about 3 months and I started to like it. I often wondered, you know, where did that liking come from for something like beer? Because it wasn't intrinsic to the material itself. I only began to like it because I had to force myself to it. And that was totally exactly what the Buddha was saying. You liked it because you wanted to like it, not because some sort of like was intrinsic to beer. And then I also started to question sex. Why do people make such a big fuss and bother about sex? A lot of time it's because you're totally conditioned and brainwashed in our society that sex is good. And if you don't enjoy it, somehow you're a sexual failure. And I obviously, there's only learned about these by reading after I became a monk. But people say that many women fake the orgasms. I don't know if that's true or not. But why do you do that? Because sex must be fun. It has to be fun. Everyone else says it's fun. And if I'm not enjoying it, there must be something wrong with me. So it's going to be fun. You make it fun. But it takes a very, very brave person to actually question this. Is it so much fun after all? What is the pleasure before, afterwards? Is it really worth it? Is this all there is? So when I say this to other people, they again think I'm really, really weird. This celibacy does make you crazy, sometimes people think. But I'm challenging people. Sometimes your perceptions of what's experienced, say, under sex, can you rely on that? Or is that perception conditioned? You're perceiving that, just filtering in all the pleasurable experiences, filtering out all the unpleasant. Why? Because that's a view which has been imposed upon you by the society in which we live. Challenging. But when you start to challenge those perceptions, especially when you give up all desire and ill will, when you have a really open mind, a free mind, with no vested interest in finding for one side or the other, then you can maybe get some truth. So by stilling the mind and by overcoming these likes and dislikes, these wants and not wants, and especially being afraid of seeing things which maybe will challenge the very fundamental ground of your being, by challenging that, by being open to that, you have a chance of seeing the truth. And there is really only one way. And that is stilling the mind to such a point that all desire, all ill will, all fear is abandoned. And it's just not part of your mental makeup anymore. You're sitting there and you're so at peace, you've got no desire at all. You don't want anything. You're totally content. And there's no ill will left. You've got this beautiful mind of metta, which will be kind to anything, material thing or even metaphysical thing. You open the door of your heart to any truth, no matter how challenging. And also, there's no fear. Whatever comes up, you're willing to see. Even if you're going to lose something. That fearlessness comes when you've overcome so much of your attachments. You are free. Free to see. And that is the job of samadhi, is to suppress the 5 hindrances. The first 2 is desire and ill will, wanting and not wanting. What gives you the preferences? Obviously the 2 you all know, sloth and torpor, when you're just too dull to really see the truth. And the other one is restlessness, when you're not still enough, you're not there long enough to see the truth. And I explain that's the way that distorts perception by the way that that simile of walking up the hill to this monastery. The slower you go, the more you see. When you're really still, you see everything. And the doubts. The doubt is again just following our views. We don't really know, so we just believe what other people say. We don't see it for ourselves. So when all of that is suspended, when especially the doubt, you just suspend all you're ever told and all you're ever believed, and you're willing to sacrifice any belief for the sake of truth, then you are ready to see the Dhamma. Then delusion is suspended and you have the opportunity, as the Buddha said, to see things as they truly are and to overcome this very perverse delusion. That's why I say that it's important never to allow your knowledge to stand in the way of truth. So all you've ever been taught by myself and by other teachers, all you've ever read, all you've ever been told, in deep meditation you have to put all of that aside. Otherwise it will just again distort your perceptions and you won't see the truth anymore. Everything has to be put aside. Which is one of the problems, because sometimes monks spend so much time, so many years learning things like Abhidhamma, and they just will not let it go. Sometimes we invest so many hours of pain doing Vipassana retreats and we won't let it go. That must be right because I've sacrificed so much for it. Everything has to be willing to be let go of in order to see the truth. Never allow your knowledge and your experience to stand in the way of that truth. It has to be abandoned. And with that abandoning, with that empty mind, you have a chance of seeing the truth. And of course, the big truth you see is there's no one in here. That's the biggest one. One of the similes which I invented many, many years ago. It's a great simile, but again, it's one of the golden oldies, about the driverless bus. It's like that many people live their life, they come to a meditation retreat, they go to a religious place, they learn things, because they want to get their life together. They just had too much suffering in life. And sometimes people come to meditation retreats just because they're not really to get enlightened, but to have a happier life. You know, to have more success in business, less stress, to get over their cancers, to be a better lover or whatever. Amazing just what people learn meditation for. But when people sort of come to a retreat like this, they come for those sorts of reasons. It's just like a person who's been living their life and sometimes they have suffering and they try their hardest to get out of that suffering as soon as they possibly can. But their suffering lasts longer than it should. Why is it I'm still hurting because of this? And why is it causing me so much problems? There must be a way out of this, a shortcut to get out of this problem. And there are other times when you're having a wonderful life, things are going so well for you, you're happy, and you just want to be sharp and wise enough to maintain that happiness for longer and longer and longer. And what happens? It doesn't last as long as it should. And the suffering lasts too long and the happiness doesn't last long enough. Why? What can I do to try and extend my happiness and lessen my suffering? So, you know, you try and control yourself better. And this is where the simile of the driverless bus comes in. It's like a person who is in a bus journey. And sometimes your bus goes through this beautiful territory, just rolling hills and waterfalls and fish and chip shops, beautiful territory, just so scenic. And you say, stop, or at least slow down. And your bus driver speeds up. He doesn't even go slow, let alone stop. He speeds up, stupid bloody bus driver. And other times you're going through this terrible territory. It just looks so ugly and so despicable. And you're going through that ugly territory and you tell the bus driver, no, quicken up, get out of here soon. And what does a bus driver do? Slows down, even comes to a stop. You stupid bus driver, this is an unpleasant place to stay. Get out of here. But no, it slows down and stops. And of course, you start blaming your bus driver. Stupid bus driver, stupid me. So you come here to fix yourself up so you're smarter and wiser. But before you could actually teach the bus driver, you know, what he's supposed to be doing, you've got to find the bus driver first of all. So it's like you're in the seat of your bus and you get up from your seat and you walk to the front where the bus driver sits so you can give him proper instructions. And then when you get to the bus driver's seat, that's where you get the shock of your life. There's no one there. The bus driver's seat is empty. Just like when you start to sort of fix up your life. And you come here and find it's the wheel is stupid. You know, it wants to be happy, but it just creates suffering. You know, it wants to be healthy, and I keep getting sick. You know, I want to sort of have a nice meditation, and I keep sort of thinking too much. Stupid me, stupid bus driver. So in this meditation, you find your bus driver's seat. You go deep inside to the jhana realms. That's where the bus driver sits. And you see your bus driver. Oh, my God, there's no one there. And that's where you get the great insights. Because what happens when you see the bus driver's seat is empty? What do? Just go down back to your seat and shut up. What's the point of complaining? No one there to listen. So, nice territory, just let it be. It will pass. Beautiful territory, let it be. It will pass too. So, no desire, no aversion. No controlling. Waste of time controlling. Shouting at the bus driver, no one's there. So that's what happens. But you know, it's a very hard thing to see that, because one doesn't want to see that. You know, one wants to be in control. I want to be here. I don't want to go. I don't want to disappear. I want to be in control. So you're in denial of that. So it's so hard to find that bus driver's seat. But in deep meditation, you've got no choice. You let go. No desire, no ill will. Just sitting here making peace. So you can see things as they truly are. Not as you want them to be, but as they truly are. When you see things as they truly are, that has the consequence. Delusion is abandoned. You see things as they truly are. You know there's no one in here. You sit back in your seat. Actually, you still sometimes swear at the bus driver, just a bad habit, that's all. Stupid driver, it's a waste of time, there's no one there, but you still say stupid driver. And that's the bad habits which linger for a while. Because once a person has seen the Dhamma, seen the truth, your delusion has been overcome. The view is now perfected. So your view is correct. But that takes a while. Before it filters in to your perceptual function. Only when the view is right, you start to perceive according to that view. And after the view is right, then the thinking becomes in line. When the view and the thinking comes in line with the Dhamma, you're the non-returner. You don't have any more thoughts of lust or ill will. And that's the difference between a stream winner and a non-returner. It's that time lag between perfecting your view, seeing it clearly, and then allowing that to overcome this habitual bending of the truth to fit what you wanted to see, and blocking out what you don't want to see. If you want to sort of try this, I know that a couple of people, I've seen them meditating with eye shades on. What you can do today is put your eye shades on when you're having lunch. And get someone else to put the food on your plate. And they can guide your hands to sort of, you know, the spoon, so you put it into your mouth rather than up your nose. And when you sort of put it in your mouth, what are you eating? And it's a totally different experience, isn't it? Apparently they've got restaurants in the big capital cities, which are totally dark, so I read in the newspapers. And it was actually the waiters, they wear nighttime goggles, so at least they can see where to put the plates of food. But people are in total dark, and you have your meal, you don't know what you're eating, and it's a totally different experience. So, I mean, what you like and what you don't like, you don't know what it is until you've sort of eaten it. And a lot of times, things you really dislike, you eat it, that was really nice. And then afterwards, wow, I don't like that. It's amazing just how our views actually bend our perceptions. Some years ago, many years ago, I got invited to give a talk at Rolling Stone Primary School. And, you know, sometimes I just accept these things without asking for more information. And when I got there, I found I was teaching year ones and year twos, grade one and grade twos, Buddhism. And that was really a challenge. I mean, how do you teach Buddhism to, you know, 5- and 6-year-olds? And it's hard enough to teach Buddhism to 50- and 60-year-olds, 5- and 6-year-olds. And how are you going to do that? You're going to teach them about, you know, make peace, be kind, be gentle? Yeah, sure. And they know all about being peaceful, 5- and 6-year-olds. You're going to tell them about Four Noble Truths? Yeah, they're sure to understand that. They can't even count to four yet. So how am I going to teach these 5- and 6-year-olds? So, you know, you came up with an innovative method, which is why I remember it. And if I sort of, if I bombed out, I wouldn't be telling you. But it's actually worked. So I had year ones and year twos, about sort of 60 or 80 kids there in this room. And they're all sort of looking at me as if I'm really weird, which, you know, to them I was. And I said, ask them a question. Can you put your hands up if you like rice pudding? That was the question. And kids are good like that. If you ask them a question, they will put their hands up. You know, they're not like you guys. You ask them a question, no one puts their hands up at all. So that's what kids are like. So about, of the class of about 80, about 3 or 4, no, maybe 5 kids put their hand up. Oh, no, sorry, the question was, do you hate rice pudding? Do you not like rice pudding? And 5 or 6 kids put their hand up. They didn't like rice pudding. And then all the other kids, they were looking around. And they saw these 5 or 6 kids with their hands up. So a few other kids put their hands up. Then a few other kids put their hands up. And with about 1 minute, he had all the kids put their hand up. The whole 60 kids had agreed they did not like rice pudding. And then the killer question, put your hands down, kids. Now, can you please put your hands up if you've ever eaten rice pudding? And about 10 kids put their hands up. And all the other kids laughed. They got it. And there's a simple question like that. I taught them delusion. The basic teaching of the Buddha. Because other kids don't like rice pudding, therefore I don't like it either. You haven't even tasted it yet. You can see how delusion works. How it is culturally conditioned. Even, as I said, that question last night. Being in a society where grief did not exist. Can that be? It was. That was true. Much of your grief, if not all of it, culturally conditioned. Just one way of looking at things. And because it's so deeply ingrained into us, the very idea that you could have a loss without grief is just incomprehensible. That doesn't mean it's not true. Because it's incomprehensible, our view is that it cannot exist. Therefore, no, it won't exist. It can't exist. Therefore, for you, it doesn't exist. But it does exist. That's called delusion. So, how do you overcome those many delusions of life and get real and see what the Buddha saw? Exactly, just make peace, be kind, be gentle, get still. And so you've got no vested interest. You've got never allowing your knowledge, your experience to stand in the way of truth. You're seeing things afresh, you're letting go of the past. In this moment, just seeing what's there and being open to it. Not wanting this, not denying that, not restless, not sleepy, clear, bright, seeing. And then your whole world changes. You overcome delusion. And that's how people become enlightened. You can't become enlightened by working it out, by thinking. That's why insight based on thought is no insight at all. It has to be insight based on stillness. The stillness where there's no desire and no ill will. A clear, bright mind who's willing to see, things which challenge you to the core. That's where insight really comes from. That's why this retreat is an insight retreat. And you still have another 24 hours and a bit more. That's how many? That's about 86,000 seconds. Is that right? Still plenty of seconds left. It only takes 1 second to see the Dhamma. So you've got about 86,000 opportunities left. So, don't go packing your bags yet. Bianca asked me, if you have packed your bags already, please unpack them. Why do people pack their bags and they haven't even left the retreat yet? For those who don't know this story, this is a true story by one of my friends. He was a monk in Korea many years ago. His name was Ham Wong. He was from New Zealand. And he actually came to visit Ajahn Chah, but he preferred to practice his meditation in South Korea, in a very, very strict monastery. We were tough, but his monastery was far tougher. They did a retreat every year, a 60-day retreat, but very, very different than this place. The retreat was structured. You got up in the morning, I think at 3 o'clock, and you had to sit. 50 minutes sitting, 10 minutes walking, 50 minutes sitting, 10 minutes walking, throughout the whole day. You had your one meal of the day. You didn't go to the dining room. The food was brought to where you were sitting. So you couldn't even leave. The only time you could leave the meditation hall was to go to the toilets. And you only had a certain few minutes to go there, or to see the meditation master for the interview. And the meditation master at the interview never said, "Very good, very good." You always say, "You stupid, very bad," bang, bang, bang with the stick. It was a very tough place. And this was like a Westerner, wasn't used to sitting on the floor so long. And he told me, I remember telling me the story, I wrote about it in Open the Door of Your Heart. Just after the first day, you know, meditating to about 11 o'clock, and then you just lay down where you were sitting. His knees and back really started to hurt. He couldn't go and take a rest in his room. He had to stay there. And that was only the first day, and 89 days to go. After the first week, he was in agony. And he thought that this is stupid, he was in so much pain, no peace, just for 50 minutes sitting and 10 minutes walking. And he really thought, you know, he was not going to make this, that something was going to sort of go seriously wrong with his health. But he always would look around and seeing all these Korean monks sitting perfectly straight. And one thing about Westerners, we're proud. We think, you know, if those Asians can do it, I can do it. So it was just his racism kept him going for a little bit longer. So another couple of weeks, then he managed to push himself through, but it was incredibly agonizing. And after 2 weeks he thought, gee, you know, if I give up now, sort of all that 2 weeks of endurance would be for nothing. So now that investment of 2 weeks of effort kept him going for another couple of weeks. And eventually, you know, you get to the halfway mark, you know, it's like I'm halfway now, it's all sort of downhill from here. But it wasn't downhill, it was all uphill. 30 days, 40 days, 50 days. And he said that sometimes the pain was so great he felt like crying. You know, he was a tough man, a young man, but it still, it just hurt so much. And he managed to keep it going. 55 days. And of course it always comes like the last day, 59 days. And when he woke up, in the morning of the 59 days, his body was still hurting as soon as he woke up, really in agony, but he thought, only in one more day to go, and only a few more hours, surely I can make this. But the amazing thing is, when you do something like this, the very last day is always the worst. It's as if, you know, the pain had, you know, been pulling its punches, but the last day gives you everything it's got. And that last day was the worst day of his life. which was so agonizing. But soon you got to the last meditation session, the last 50 minutes. And he knew that when that 50 minutes was over, the retreat would be completed. And usually what they have is hot baths. And just the idea of a hot bath in his aching body, oh, that was just like going to heaven. And there'd be food, and you could relax, you'd go to bed early, you can have a walk, you can exercise. And just so that expectation of what was going to come next just kept him going for that last 50 minutes. And he said that, you know, the last 50 minutes, he'd opened his eyes. You know, half an hour must have gone past by now. Only 5 minutes had gone. The last 50 minutes was not like 50 minutes, was like 50 hours. And he started to think, he told me, the clock's going so slow. Maybe the batteries have run out. It's unfair. But sooner or later you came to the last minute. And then the abbot, the teacher, rang the bell, the gong. And he said that was the sweetest sound he'd ever heard in his life. The retreat was over. 90 days of sheer hell. And he'd endured it. And he felt so proud of himself, so good about himself. And, you know, just started thinking, the hot bath in a few minutes, oh, yeah. And then the abbot rang the bell again. Said, I've got an announcement to make. Said, this has been a special retreat, said the abbot. Many of you in your interviews have been telling me how much progress you've been making. And you've asked me, out of compassion, to extend the retreat for another 10 days. I agree. Sit down, the retreat's carrying on. And poor old Havel, he said he had to follow. No hot baths, no relaxation, another 10 days of agony. But he said when he closed his eyes, he didn't feel any pain. Because all he felt was this sheer anger. Who are those bloody monks who said that? And all, he started thinking of all the torture he was going to inflict on those monks when he possibly could. And he said 20 minutes went past in a flash and they heard the gong go again. And the abbot said, retreat over. And he was just confused. What do you mean retreat over? I thought we were going for another 10 days. And everyone else was up into the hot bath and he was sitting there. What's going on? And then one of his friends came up and said, look, don't worry about this. The abbot does the same thing every year. It was like a trick just to show him just the delusion which expectation gives you. And anger, what anger does for you. It's totally a deluded state of mind. You're not seeing things as they truly are. So actually, during the interviews, some of you have been saying, this is a very wonderful retreat. So unpack your bags, no one's going home. But don't pack your bags until the very end, the very last minute, because you'll find that that's what you do in your whole life. You're one of these people always packing their bags a day or two in advance, always being ahead of yourself. You know, apparently some people order their coffin before they're dead. What a crazy thing to do. Apparently, isn't it a sort of a Chinese tradition, you order your coffin and bring it in the house because people think that you're going to live much longer? I think it's more like your children, the reminder, come on, Mum, come on, Dad. So whatever, don't rush life. So now you've got lots and lots of time, so enjoy it. Every moment counts. You don't know what's going to happen next. So please don't pack your bags until, apparently, packing bag time is tomorrow morning after 9 o'clock after the talk. So to keep it nice and quiet for everybody else. And keep on meditating. Make peace, be kind, be gentle, be still. And see if you can get to this mind which has no wants, no ill will, which is clear and fearless, so it can overcome delusion once and for all, and see what's truly there. So you'll know that your path is not a foolish path, it is a true path, because all your likes and dislikes have disappeared. You're not bending perception anymore. You're actually seeing the truth. And that's a wonderful gift, the gift of wisdom. So that's the talk for this morning on delusion and how to overcome it. Any questions? That was quick, yeah? Sometimes you use imagination can be a useful tool, but sometimes it can be a dangerous tool as well, because you can just imagine your way to being even enlightened, but you're not. So the only way you can understand whether delusion is there or not is whether there's any likes and dislikes, any wanting. If you're really still, if the mind is absolutely peaceful. And as I said, you know, I think I said this last night, the best way of knowing stillness is when Metta the dog wags her tail violently. So happy, so joyful. So it's that joy and happiness which come from stillness, which is the easiest recognizable sign. That old simile of Vipassana, Samatha, and Metta the dog going up meditation mountain. The more progress you make, the more you can see. But that can be very sort of hard to discern whether you're seeing a lot or whether you're just imagining it. More and more peaceful. But sometimes peace, we're not really quite sure how deep peace should be. But Metta the dog, that happiness, that kindness, that's pretty easy to recognize. So the sign that it's getting into deep, high up meditation mountain. Peace should be there, clarity there. The easiest recognizable thing is a bliss. Just the way that Metta the dog wags her tail. I've seen some of these dogs wag their tail, and just why it doesn't fall off, I just don't know. It's just wagging so fast. That's what it's like in deep meditation. So it's the joy and the bliss. And I'm not just saying that, that's just when people come to me and say they've had a very deep meditation, that's the sign I look out for the most. What type of bliss? How much bliss? How long did it last afterwards? What's the echo of that beautiful state? Okay, yes, Bormin. What's the point of the four elements? They've got no point, they just are four elements. So what's the point of that question? Okay, you can ask me in your interview time. Any other questions before we... Yes? Was that good? Most of the pain, a tiny part of the pain is physical. But most of the pain, I don't want to feel this pain, I don't want to feel this pain. And just a few minutes later and it's going to go, a few minutes later and it's going to go. That actually makes the pain worse. So sometimes you notice that, you know, only after a few more minutes I'll be back home, I can lay down, whatever. That makes it worse, the expectation. So instead, you're just with the pain, you be kind to it, you're here, rather than trying to be somewhere else. And then you're taking out what the Buddha called the mental error. I want to be somewhere else. It's the wanting which creates most of the pain in life. He created the mental error too much. And he substituted that mental error with another mental error, just anger at those monks. And you're so consumed by anger, like people are, they forget everything else. Sometimes people are so consumed by anger. What are the cases of people playing sport? They break their leg and they just carry on playing because they're so focused on winning the game. They just can't feel the physical pain in the body. And anger sometimes is of the same type. You're so angry you don't realize what you're doing to yourself or what pain you have. So it's all come from expectations. You know, from only 45 days to go, only 10 days to go, only one day to go, that's suffering. Where you know, to go where? I remember one of the members of our Buddhist society, he gave me a nice little reflection. He asked me how things going, and I said, I'm getting there. He said, getting where? That's actually a good question. Where am I getting? So if anyone ever asks you, you know, how are you? And you say you're getting there. Getting where? So instead of trying to be getting there, say be here. Being here is much better than getting there. So someone asks you, how are you going? You say, I'm being here. That's much better than getting there. There's no expectations. So how's your meditation going? Are you getting there? No, you're being here. Okay, end of talk. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, so now we have interviews for those who want interviews. And the power is building up. 8 days of talks and meditation. So, who knows, this, the most powerful day, Friday. Friday in Malaysia and Singapore, with some of you on, that's the holy day. Even in Australia, Friday is the holy day of the week. It is, that's when you get paid. That's why it's holy. So this is payday today. So, your check is coming. The postman will arrive sometimes today. Please be alert and at home when he comes. If you're somewhere else, sleep or dreaming or thinking about the future, then when the postman calls, you won't be able to receive the parcel of jhana or nimittas or enlightenment. So please be here every moment, waiting in a moment for the postman to deliver your check. Payday today.